Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Do you want to live in a diverse neighborhood? Do you live in a diverse neighborhood? Have you ever run away from a diverse neighborhood? If any of those sound like you, call us up. Tell us your ethnicity or other identity group and how much you want to live among people of your own group, how much you want to live among people not of your own group, and how much choice you feel you have given the realities of life. What would your ideal urban neighborhood be like in people, in qualities? And does it exist? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And we ask because the renowned Harvard sociologist William Julius Wilson joins us now to talk about his new book, There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods and Their Meaning for America. It's co-authored with sociologist Richard Taub from the University of Chicago and just published by Knopf. They've been following these four Chicago neighborhoods to see who moves in, who moves out, and how diverse residents interact. So, Professor Wilson, it's great to have you back on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we will mix the results of your study with stories from our diverse listeners about their ideal neighborhoods and their real-life neighborhood histories. So, listeners, do you want to live in a diverse neighborhood? Do you live in a diverse neighborhood? Have you ever run away from a diverse neighborhood? What would your ideal urban neighborhood be like in people and qualities, and does it exist? We will save some lines for people of different groups, so don't be offended if we bump you because we're getting too many of one calling in. We only have 10 lines. So call us up, 212-433-WNYC, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. So, Dr. Wilson, what kinds of neighborhoods did you study?
We studied a black neighborhood, a white neighborhood, a Latino neighborhood, and a neighborhood that changed while we were doing our research from white ethnic to Latino. These neighborhoods were neither poor nor affluent. These are lower middle class, working class neighborhoods. Neighborhoods that represent ordinary Americans, in other words.
For our listeners who know Chicago and may be wondering, we should say you have given pseudonyms in the book to the four neighborhoods you studied. Why didn't you want to identify the neighborhoods by their real names?
Because there's some rather sensitive materials in the book, and we just felt that we wanted to protect the anonymity of our respondents and informers.
Over what period of time did you study the neighborhoods?
We studied the neighborhood for 3 years, and we were there from 1993 to 1996.
Oh, and this is just getting published now.
Yeah, and we updated the book with the data from 2000 census.
So you write in the book that you're testing the theories of an economist named Albert Hirschman about who will flee from neighborhood change and why.
Yes.
What was Hirschman's theory?
Well, basically, the theory is that when residents perceive that in-migration presents a threat to their neighborhood, they will either react by exiting the neighborhood or by joining forces with others to resist the change. And that's the basic thesis of Hirschman's theory. And he also adds another important component, that is loyalty. The more loyal people are to a neighborhood, the more likely they are to remain when facing the looming threat of racial, ethnic, or class changes.
But it's interesting to me that Hirschman's theory, as you describe it in the book, is less about race or ethnicity or even class,
right,
but more about neighborhood qualities, safety, cleanliness,
yes,
good schools, and things like that, you say.
Yes. What we try to do in the book is show an association between what we call the social organization of the neighborhood and the way the residents react to racial change or ethnic change. By social organization, we mean the extent to which the residents of the neighborhood are able to maintain effective social control and realize their common goals or values. And the point is that we make in the book is that the stronger the social organization of the neighborhood, the more likely that the local residents will take steps internally to keep the area stable. And we argue that residents are more likely to choose the exit option, to leave the neighborhood when they're facing the threat of a change, when they feel the neighborhood's resources are insufficient to stem the tide of ethnic or racial change.
Give me an example of each. What kind of organized neighborhood, what kind of neighborhood without those kinds of resources?
One of the neighborhoods that we study is Dover, which is a neighborhood that changed from white ethnic to Latino. The white residents in that neighborhood, when they saw the Latinos moving in, chose to exit the neighborhood, creating a tipping point or a rapid ethnic or racial transformation of the neighborhood. I said that Dover is the neighborhood that changed from white ethnic to Latino. Dover is a neighborhood that featured weak neighborhood social organization, as reflected in public conflicts over the use of language, Spanish, English, declining business and civic organizations, cultural clashes between whites and Latinos in churches, and so on. It's interesting that in churches, groups segregated themselves. You know, churches conducted masses in Spanish in the morning and English in the afternoon, so the ethnic groups had little opportunity to interact.
Well, if you have two populations that speak a different language, then you kind of have to segregate, but I gather you're saying it went further than that.
Well, yeah, not only did they segregate themselves, but there was, you know, a good deal of tension between the groups and hostility and what we call ethnic antagonism.
Let's take a phone call. Kristen in what she calls Bed-Stuy Clinton Hill. Hi, Kristen.
Well, I was calling. This is very interesting to me, particularly because of the block that my husband and I live on. We're an interracial couple ourselves. I'm white. He's black. Mm-hmm. We live on a block that actually does border Bed-Stuy and Clinton Hill, and there's a lot of changing going on here. It's one of the still relatively affordable areas of the city. Our block has very strong economic, racial, religious, educational diversity. We have a Columbia professor. We have a public housing building. And we like the diversity. We love Brooklyn. We like a mixture of peoples and backgrounds, et cetera, but something that we wish perhaps there was a little less of is a diversity of values.
Around what? What kinds of values?
Well, and values is kind of it can be a very loaded word these days, but in direct association to the way people treat property and the way they behave and what's quote-unquote acceptable, that would be the only thing that would mm-hmm. drive us away from this neighborhood is that because of the diverse backgrounds of peoples, oh, sometimes we just have to put up with things that we'd rather not and that you wouldn't find in other areas of Brooklyn or New York City.
So, Professor Wilson, this would seem to go to Hirschman's theory of safety and cleanliness and things like that, which are the same things that Kristen is articulating as issues in Bed-Stuy Clinton Hill. I don't know if you're familiar with Bed-Stuy and Clinton Hill in Brooklyn and whether you think there's any relationship between New York and Chicago in this respect.
Well, I think that, you know, many of the neighborhoods that we talk about in Chicago are found in other cities like New York. You know, people say, well, Chicago is more segregated than other major cities, but all neighborhoods have variation in the degree of racial tensions and all cities in this country with multiracial and ethnic groups have situations in which one racial or ethnic group moves into a neighborhood occupied by another racial and ethnic group, creating tensions that could lead to neighborhood change. And you talk about common values. That's one of the tensions created when new groups move in is that sometimes they have values that conflict with the values of the group who's lived in a neighborhood for many years.
So, Kristen, do you see the values questions that you're raising that make it sometimes uncomfortable for you to live in your neighborhood, surrogates for racial questions, or, you know, afraid that people may think that they're surrogates for racial prejudice?
Can you explain a little bit what you mean about surrogates?
Well, I mean, like, you know, some people, I mean, the classic white flight, I think your situation is very different, but the classic white flight would involve white people in Bed-Stuy in the 50s and 60s who said, well, the neighborhood is changing, it's becoming more dangerous,
right.
And they move away, yeah. And then black people say, oh, you didn't want to live among black people.
Yeah. Well, how it really occurs today is that more white people are moving in.
Right. It's the other way. It's the gentrification.
I think that's largely economic. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Professor.
One of our neighborhoods is Groveland, which is a black neighborhood, sort of a lower middle class neighborhood. And the black residents in that neighborhood, 97% of the residents are black, are very, very concerned about the possible penetration of lower class blacks in the ghettos surrounding their neighborhood. And they react in ways that are not unsimilar to the way that the whites mm-hmm. react to blacks.
So did you document black flight from that neighborhood?
No. This is a neighborhood that was very, very strong, a neighborhood that exercised what Hirschman calls voice. That is to say, they decided that they were going to work to keep the neighborhood stable and scrutinize newcomers who come in. And they work very, very effectively to maintain neighborhood stability. It'd be interesting to see whether or not they'll be able to achieve that stability over the long haul.
William Julius Wilson, the renowned Harvard sociologist with us, co-author with sociologist Richard Taub of There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods. And we're taking phone calls on your ideal neighborhood, how diverse it is, what other qualities it has, and if it exists, at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Tia in Jackson Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tia.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Did you hear Sammy from Sammy's Halal from Jackson Heights before?
And I very much enjoy Sammy's food and have and was happy to hear that he had won the Vendy.
A customer. Okay. So what'd you call to say in this segment?
I called to say that I feel like I live in one of the ideal neighborhoods of New York. It's one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the entire city. I grew up on Long Island. I'm second generation American, Puerto Rican, Italian, and Irish. I always joke that I'm a reflection of New York at the turn of the century and who was mixing with whom. And, you know, my family moved out to Long Island. They have that typical immigrant's, aspiration and got the house out on Long Island. Then when I went away to college and came back to New York, and I actually moved to Brooklyn. And I moved to a neighborhood which was being called at the time South Slope, but it was really Sunset Park. And since I grew up around here, I knew that it was Sunset Park.
Real estate agents call it South Slope, so it sounds like it's in
right.
Park Slope.
Well, there's all sorts of neighborhoods that kind of new names. Anyhow, so I moved into the neighborhood and was one of the few white young professionals on the block and very much felt the tension on the block and felt the hostility of my neighbors and understood the struggle that were participating in.
What do you think
to
the
maintain
struggle,
their housing.
What do you think the struggle was at root over?
That I was coming in and I was paying double or triple what they had been paying, and they had been on that block for a long time.
Tia, thank you very much. And Professor Wilson, in your Chicago study, were any of them gentrifying neighborhoods?
None of the neighborhoods that we studied were gentrifying. That is to say, we only had one black neighborhood, and it was a lower middle class neighborhood. The other neighborhoods were also sort of lower middle class, working class. And none of the neighborhoods were experiencing a significant in-migration of higher income professionals, for example. But I think the point the caller is making is very important, and that is as these neighborhoods begin to gentrify, there's an increase in real estate taxes and escalating costs of renting apartments. So there may be some hostility on the part of the residents to the in-migrants because they're fearful that they won't be able to remain in the neighborhood, can't afford to live there.
I'm sure there's no single best balance of ethnic diversity. It's up to individuals, and there are different successful neighborhoods, different unsuccessful neighborhoods. But here's an email from a woman in New Jersey who says, wasn't there a study some time back that found that the best balance of ethnicity in a neighborhood was one in which no ethnic group had the majority, or if not that, then the majority remained white middle class while other ethnicities each were largely represented, but none constituted a majority. I myself am African-American female, age 44, have found that the most comfortable place is one in which there is diversity, but no group has the upper hand, and one in which there is substantial home ownership, not just renters. Professor William Julius Wilson, does that neighborhood exist in real life?
Yeah, there are some neighborhoods like that that are have a sort of multi-ethnic with no really significantly dominant a group, and many of these neighborhoods have a substantial number of homeowners. That's very important. The higher the percentage of homeowners, the more stable the neighborhood is likely to be. I find that just in sort of the research that I was doing for this book is that the neighborhoods like that tend to be neighborhoods that include the residents who find it difficult to leave or to move to another area, either because they have to live in that neighborhood, maybe they work for the city or something, or because they just can't afford to move to other areas. And therefore, they remain in that neighborhood even though there may be some possibility of significant ethnic or racial change.
We'll continue in a minute with William Julius Wilson, the renowned sociologist. His new book, There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods and Their Meaning for America. We'll talk more about their meaning for America and for New York. We'll take more phone calls from you on your ideal neighborhood and how close to that you are able to find to live in real life. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with sociologist William Julius Wilson, author of There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods and Their Meaning for America, and your calls on what your ideal urban neighborhood would be like in people, in qualities, and does it exist? And Annette in Laurelton, Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Annette.
Good morning to you. When I first moved to Laurelton in the early 60s, we worked very hard with the Black Association to try to maintain a diverse neighborhood. Well, looking at the neighborhood today, I guess it really didn't work, but we really didn't get much help from the city also when during the Koch administration when we fought very hard to try to get a police substation in the neighborhood.
So now it's overwhelmingly African-American?
Right, but I would say that it's not because we didn't want to work together with those who, you know, who stayed and tried to make it, but eventually they left. But it's a very viable neighborhood, even though, you know, it is an African American neighborhood.
Laurelton's a middle class neighborhood, right?
Right, and the homes have increased in value, and it's one of the a very desirable neighborhood to live in. And I'm sorry that. That all the work that we did, it really didn't help because, as I said, for those of us who did work with the Federation and the Black Association, people moved away. And sometimes it's very sad because, there are people who really want to have a diverse neighborhood, but for some reason in New York, I still say New York is very territorial and... What I do feel very good about, though, that the people who are in Laurelton are people who are hardworking and maintain their property and are very proud people. So it's a lot of factors. The city has a lot to do with it. The politics have a lot to do with it also,
right,
when the neighborhood changes and when you don't get the services that you're entitled to. And that, I think, has a lot to do with it also.
Are you in, you're in City Councilman Leroy Comrie's district?
No. My council person is Saunders.
Uh-huh.
And my Congressman Meeks.
Right. So William Julius Wilson, here's a story that seems to play right into the kind of things you were studying, where the new population at that time in the 70s was trying to foster bonds of community organization and failed.
Yes. Well, again, this gets back to the basic thesis of neighborhood social organization, you know, and apparently the social organization in neighborhood, that is the extent to which the residents were able to maintain control and realize their values, which was not strong enough. Now, we find that the neighborhoods that experience the greatest racial, ethnic, or class stability would be those that not only feature strong neighborhood social organizations and community identity or loyalty to the neighborhood, but those in which most of the residents find it too difficult or too expensive to move as well. And as I think about cities around the country, I would, if I were to do a study, I would hypothesize that New York, over the long term, will have more integrated neighborhoods than cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, or Cleveland.
Why?
Because it's so expensive to live there. The cities with the highest levels of neighborhood integration will be those in which the residents find it too expensive or too difficult to move.
Hmm.
So a metropolitan area like New York or San Francisco would much more likely feature neighborhoods that are integrated than cities like Detroit, Cleveland, or Philadelphia.
Although one of the dynamics that I think we're experiencing in New York right now is it's becoming a city more of rich and poor.
Yeah.
Manhattan is. I don't want to say that about the all four other boroughs necessarily, but Manhattan, you know, the richest of the rich to some degree are moving in. Middle class is thinning out. And the other people who are here are poor folks who live in existing public housing or in tenements that haven't gentrified.
Yeah, well, this also will possibly lead to more gentrification and displacement of some of these poor residents in the neighborhoods, because you're right, middle-income groups are being squeezed out, and many of them just can't afford to move to the more expensive areas. And so they're going to move into areas with a significant percentage of people of color, and that will lead to some integration and also some displacement of the
right.
poor people.
Karen in Kensington, Brooklyn now, but grew up in Chicago. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I am very interested in reading your book, Dr. Wilson. I and I love my neighborhood, Kensington. We've been here for a while.
Is that in New York City?
Sorry?
Where is your neighborhood located?
Kensington,
Brooklyn.
Oh, Brooklyn.
It's an incredibly diverse neighborhood of Brooklyn, right, Karen?
It's a wonderful neighborhood. And not only is it diverse, but I think there's been a wonderful blending of the neighbors in the neighborhoods. People do socialize together. I'm not going to say it's a nirvana, but it is a wonderful place to live. My point, though, is that I'm very interested in, as I said, in reading your book. I am from Chicago. I'm from the south side of Chicago. I moved here 27 years ago and have periodically gone back. I have family there. I went there in June and to visit my sister who lives in the neighborhood we grew up in, actually. It's called Beverly. It's on the south side.
Yes, I know Beverly. My daughter lives there.
Okay. It's a beautiful neighborhood, beautiful homes. And because of the fact that city workers do have to live in the city, as you stated before, it too, I believe, has become somewhat diverse, certainly not like my neighborhood here. But I don't see the blending there. And one thing that shocked me was we went to a restaurant that I actually used to work at on Western Avenue. Wonderful food. It's a pancake breakfast place that's open only till 3 o'clock. Wonderful, wonderful food. It's owned by a gentleman from the neighborhood. And we walked into the restaurant, my sister, my niece, and myself, and I was amazed. We were the only white people in this restaurant. Mm-hmm. And again, it's in Beverly, so it is, you know, it's very integrated there. It wasn't like there were no people living here. It's not like we had to make a journey to get there. And then we went back a few times, and again, the same experience. And I thought...
So your point is that New York is integrating better than Chicago.
Yes, and I thought, how sad, because this is a wonderful little restaurant, neighborhood place, and it's a lose-lose proposition. Everybody loses.
Yes. Let me ask you this. Do you know much about the neighborhood social organization? That is to say, do people have block clubs? Do they participate in organizations in a neighborhood so they can talk to one another and talk about ways to increase interaction between the groups?
In my neighborhood,
in
yes.
In Kensington?
Yeah, no, the neighborhood Beverly.
In Beverly.
Yeah.
There was a very old association, I believe it was called the Beverly Area Something Association, but it was more had the exclusive nature of let's say an area like Brooklyn Heights here in New York, where the old generation was wealthy, and they were really concerned with more, I think, making sure that the neighborhood stayed as it was. So I don't know for sure, but I don't think there was a lot of dialogue when things started changing there.
I'm curious about the neighborhood you now live in. You know, effective neighborhood social organization depends on residents who collectively supervise community activities, take responsibility for addressing problems in a neighborhood, people who actively participate in voluntary and formal organizations, so for example, parent-teacher organizations, civic and business groups, block clubs, churches, political groups. Would you say that would characterize your neighborhood, activities would characterize your neighborhood?
I would say that it's certainly moving more in that direction, mm-hmm. with a very diverse panel of participants.
Mm-hmm.
However, what you're describing, I think, is almost utopian. I think it's very difficult to bring everybody to the table. We are not only are we diverse, but we have a real mix of single-family homes and co-ops, and much like other neighborhoods in the city and in Brooklyn.
Kensington, tell me if I'm overstating it, but my understanding and my limited experience with Kensington is that it is so diverse that you walk down some of those single-family home blocks, and there is, you know, a white American couple, a black American family, a Caribbean American, Bangladeshi, people from Korea, from Ecuador as well. So it's like unbelievably diverse.
The beauty of especially our block is that we live next door to a gentleman who was born in the house. And now it's a second generation. And the other side of us, we have a rabbi and his family. Next to him is an African-American Muslim family. There are, across the street, are Koreans, and then there's the English couple that just bought and moved here from London. And all the kids play on the street. It really is almost a little utopian. It sounds like I'm making this stuff up.
And it's pretty new that it's so like that, and I don't know what tensions are going to develop, and I don't know just how organized, Professor Wilson, that neighborhood is. But I think that what you said about the economics of it exactly applies to Kensington and some places like it in New York, which is that it's an economic crossroads at this particular moment in time where some immigrants who are upwardly mobile are able to live there, and some middle-class, pre-existing Americans who are being forced out of gentrified neighborhoods are finding it a place that they can afford. And so they all, you know, all these groups wind up in Kensington largely for economic reasons. Karen,
you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
We, my husband, myself, and my daughter actually moved from a co-op in Brooklyn Heights and one of the toniest neighborhoods in Brooklyn. And seeing that we could get, as it were, a lot more bang for our buck as far as space. And we just happened onto something that was far superior from where we came
from. Karen, thank you very much for a really interesting call. Professor Wilson, any last thought on that?
Yeah, I think that she just reinforced what I was saying, that New York is a place that's likely to have neighborhoods more likely to have neighborhoods like that.
Yes, for exactly the reason that you said, the economics. And William Julius Wilson is my guest for another few minutes on WNYC. His new book, There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods and Their Meaning for America. One of the biggest population dynamics in Chicago as a whole that you write about, like many cities, is the rapid influx of Latinos.
Yes.
We just did another segment last hour about the conflict here in Mamaroneck, Westchester County, over day laborers and a big victory that day laborers won in court yesterday to be able to congregate if they weren't causing other kinds of problems that may have national repercussions. But did you see different dynamics in black neighborhoods becoming more Latino from white neighborhoods becoming more Latino in Chicago?
Oh, you know, what's interesting is that the only neighborhood that experienced a decline in population slightly was Groben, the black neighborhood, because no Latinos were moving in. And the Latinos, for the most part, have avoided black neighborhoods, even a somewhat desirable neighborhood like Groben. However, I predict that given the housing demand, you're going to find more and more Latinos choosing black neighborhoods as the last option. We're already seeing that in some of the neighborhoods in Chicago that we did not study. So it would be interesting dynamic to see how blacks react to Latinos moving into their neighborhoods.
In the immigration debate in this country, one of the issues, as you know, has to do with low-income, low-skill urban blacks and whether Latino immigrants, especially illegals, are taking away opportunities for the African Americans to begin to climb the economic ladder. Have you come to any conclusions about how much that is or isn't true?
Well, there's some research by George Borjas here at the University of Chicago that suggests that low-income Latinos are displacing low-skilled blacks in many jobs and are also depressing wages. And this is creating some tensions in the black neighborhood. And I suspect that over the long term, the tensions are going to increase. And I would hope that black and Latino leaders would get together and see what they can do to resolve some of the problems in between the two communities and reach some consensus as to how they can improve conditions for their respective groups.
I have a sense that a lot of black leaders don't want to speak against Latino immigrants out of a sense of solidarity of people of color.
Absolutely.
But that a lot of regular old African Americans in those neighborhoods, based on my own callers, feel much more at least ambivalent about the immigration.
I think you're absolutely correct. And it'll be an interesting thing to watch over the next few years.
A related theory about immigration is that immigrants create more jobs than they take and replenish middle-class urban life rather than drain it. And again, people compare vibrant New York in that regard to, say, struggling Detroit. What do you make of that question for Chicago?
I think that's also the case in Chicago. Property values increase, not decrease, with Latinos moving into neighborhoods because it created a greater housing demand. And unlike poor black neighborhoods that experience depopulation, poor Latino neighborhoods are experiencing an increase in population. And I would maintain that that's more healthy for the entire city than a neighborhood, significant number of neighborhoods that are losing populations, where you have abandoned buildings and vacant lots and all of the things that breed crime and disorder.
You've been at this a long time now, and your book jacket frames your study as measuring integration 42 years after the Civil Rights Act. But does this have to do with racial justice or more economics and racial preference, or can those be separated?
Actually, I think it has to do more with economics and racial preference. And what our book does is that it reveals how difficult it's going to be to achieve any meaningful integration in our society because of the different the clashes and between the groups over values and the way in which groups perceive one another. All of these things, I think, will contribute to increased racial tensions and make it difficult to achieve meaningful integration.
So do you see policy implications of your study?
Yeah, I don't think that the government would be in a position, for example, to introduce a policy of rapid desegregation in housing. That's a practical and political impossibility because people have the freedom to move, and if they don't like the situation. But I do think that the government could make urban areas more desirable places to live. I would love to see us restore to the city budgets the cuts that were made in recent years. Only 30 years ago, 18% of the city budgets were federal contributions. Now it's down to about 5%. And the moreover, under the Bush administration, federal aid to states has been drastically reduced, thereby aggravating the problems of providing basic services in cities that rely on state funds. So what I'm saying is that if you can make cities more desirable places to live, people are more likely to remain in their neighborhoods because they don't want to move. But if we continue the pattern of ignoring our cities, then we create situations in which folks facing integration will be frightened and will leave, and we have a rapid turnover and an increase in the number of segregated neighborhoods.
But before you go, is integration the ultimate goal? I mean, not all blacks, as I don't have to tell you, see integration as the goal. This is an old debate by now. Many see equality as the goal, and they may choose to take their equality and live in integrated neighborhoods or in mostly black neighborhoods. So maybe it's human nature for most people to want to live among their own. So who is victimized by the desire of people to live among their own?
I think as long as groups are separated in their segregated ethnic enclaves, you have a potential for ethnic conflict. That's one of the things that I'm concerned about. But I don't think that we can realistically achieve meaningful integration unless we accomplish some of the things that are necessary, like providing these areas with the kinds of resources that they need to make people want to remain in those neighborhoods. And so I would like to see various leaders in the ethnic communities join together in coalitions to generate a sense of interdependence to pursue collective goals such as improved public schools and expanded libraries and better parks and cleaner playgrounds, more efficient public transportation, more reliable community services ranging from street cleaning to garbage collection. These are goals, common goals, that I think you could organize groups around and develop meaningful multinational, or should say multi-ethnic coalitions. That's what I'd like to see happen in cities.
In New York, it is multinational. William Julius Wilson, the renowned Harvard sociologist, his new book, There Goes the Neighborhood, Racial, Ethnic, and Class Tensions in Four Chicago Neighborhoods and Their Meaning for America. It's co-authored with sociologist Richard Taub from the University of Chicago and just published by Knopf. An honor to have you again. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And we'll continue to take your calls, so callers stay there. Do you want to live in a diverse neighborhood? Do you live in a diverse neighborhood? Have you ever run away from a diverse neighborhood? What would your ideal urban neighborhood be like in people, in qualities, and does it exist in real life? We'll take more of your calls on that in a minute. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.